This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. I'm delighted to welcome back to the Radio Cafe Courtney White. He's co-founder and former executive director of the Kivira Coalition. He's creative director there now, and he's an author of several books. His latest is called 2% Solutions for the Planet, 50 low-cost, low-tech, nature-based practices for combating hunger, drought, and climate change. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, Mary Charlotte. Happy to be back.
Happy to have you. As usual, you're taking on non-trivial things. Combating drought,
they feel
hunger.
More non-trivial every day.
Every
too.
Day.
Gosh.
It's really true. And one of the things that fascinates me about your work and about the work of the Kivira Coalition, which I've been following all these years, and in fact, next week is the conference, and I'll be going down to that, ladies and gentlemen, and reporting from there and bringing you all kinds of interviews with people who are doing incredible work. But one thing that I find so fascinating about it is that there really is a lot of very, as you say in the subtitle of the book, low-tech work going on. And there seems to be a real advantage of low-tech thinking. Tell us about that. Tell us about your thinking on that.
Well, the way I can sort of describe it is we are confronted with big problems. I think we're all familiar with what those problems are. What we tend to do is think of big solutions to those big problems. And then when you think of big solutions, you tend to think of high-tech solutions. So if you think about climate change, you think about carbon dioxide-sucking machines or storing it underground or some kind of complex geoengineering schemes that are out there. And the reality is there are lots of small solutions to these challenges, and not just climate. There's food scarcity, you know, water, drought, things like that. And most of them are low-tech, not high-tech, and low-tech in the sense that they are nature-based. Nature still has the best ideas. So grass, soil, water, animals, food, things that have been around for a long time. The original technology is photosynthesis, if you want to think of it as a technology. Been around on the planet for a couple of billion years, and we, being humans, tend to sort of poo-poo what nature has worked out and worked well. We're going to do better than that. But in fact, these low-tech alternatives to these problems are where we should start. And, you know, Kivira has been involved in ecological restoration in creeks and rivers for many years, and we use sticks and rocks and logs and mud and grass. Doesn't get more low-tech than that,
right.
Except that the thinking behind it is pretty darn sophisticated, so the math and the geomorphology and the all that kind of stuff. So it's a blend of actual low-tech technology itself plus some sophisticated thinking, and that goes for a lot of the solutions that are in the book.
One of the things that is a basic feature of nature that human beings seem to sometimes forget is that nature is all about relationships. So in any ecosystem, you find many, many, many different components, and big, huge fields of corn or wheat are very unnatural. And one of the things that I think is really cool about your book is that there's all kinds of mixings of things that you don't usually
right.
think of together. Like, for example, what is a flerd?
A flerd. Well, nature likes polycultures. So that's kind of a big word, but it poly means many. So many things together. It's a way it builds resilience in systems for drought or fire or whatever that comes along. Things that are diverse and complex tend to do better under adverse conditions. Humans tend to simplify. We tend to make monocultures out of things, and we tend to separate things. And so one of the things that's happened historically is we tend to separate farming from ranching, and even within ranching, we tend to separate animals out. So a flerd is a herd of cattle and a flock of sheep. Most sheep men and women and cattle ranchers think the other animal is some kind of, you know, livestock of the devil, and they've kept them apart over the years. Well, there's a couple of folks who I ran across have mixed these animals together. Mixed species grazing is what it's called. A flirt is kind of its nickname. In particular, I profile a flirt farmer in Australia named Eric Harvey, who was in Africa and saw a flirt in operation, and he realized that this is how nature liked to do things, meaning to mix species together. So on his farm in New South Wales, he took a large group of cattle and a large group of sheep, and he put them together, and he moves them around the landscape as a unit. And nature likes animals to herd together as a unit and move it around. Think of bison in the old days in the American Midwest. It was great prairie, big herds moving around. In this case, he moves them as a single flirt, as a unit, cattle and sheep together. And the idea being that they eat different things. They have different impact on the ground with their hooves, different manures. And all of this has been very beneficial to his farm. It really kind of gives a grazing shot of energy to the landscape, and he moves the animals away so they don't graze again for a long period of time. And he just has found biodiversity to explode on his farm as a consequence. It's carefully managed, and he watches and monitors very carefully, but the idea that you have these two animals grazing together. And it's just a theme in the whole book where different kinds of things have been held apart. When you bring them together the way nature intended, then all kinds of benefits can happen. Another quick example is pasture cropping, also from Australia. And this is a sheep farmer named Colin Seiss who intercrops, no-till drills, a annual wheat in this case, or oats, into his perennial pasture. So he gets a crop growing up through the grass, and that's not what's done around the world.
So wait a minute, you're talking about you've got a pasture where cows are eating?
Yes.
So and then you plant a crop inside of that pasture.
Right.
You plant a wheat crop. Then the cows don't eat it?
So he plants the seeds in the winter when it's cold, and then they come up first because they're annuals, and they come up there. They like the early growth. Then he harvests them, and then the grass grows during the warm season. So comes the annual crop, and then it gets harvested, and then come the animals in after it, and they graze on the grass. And it's a very different way of looking at food production, which tends to keep cropping systems and grazing systems separate from each other. He put them together. He noticed that nature likes weeds and other kinds of annuals to grow in pasture crops, but we keep them separate. So he's getting two food substances from 1 acre of land, which I think has huge implications for sustainable food production potentially. And it's all nature-based. He's putting a lot of carbon in the soils and water retention, all this kind of stuff. And it's taken off in Australia. It hasn't made its way to America just yet, maybe in a couple of small places. But any place you have a cold winter and have a true dormant season, you can plant those seeds, and up they come in the spring.
When you have things like that, you know, something like pasture cropping, and you also have crops that are planted together, which in the Southwest we know about this. We know about the Three Sisters, corn, squash, and beans, and the you know, the beans can use the corn to grow up on, and the squash can guard the soil, and they really, and one fixes nitrogen, the other takes nitrogen. I mean, it's a beautiful combination, keeps the soil fertile. It's just an example of sustainable agriculture, very low tech. Is it also very labor intensive? Do you need a lot of people out there?
No. And the grazing system that I described, Eric Harvey and Colin Sias both do it largely by themselves. I mean, once you've trained up a group of animals to, however you're controlling them, usually it's electric fencing, they remain trained for life, and you just move them around, and they understand not to touch the fences, and off you go. So it's not labor intensive. It's really more mind intensive. It's a different way of thinking about things. And Colin likes to say it's not about the material on the ranch, is really more about how you perceive the world. And so if you perceive the world as keeping things separate, then you're going to really create more work for yourself. If you put them together, just look at the world differently, then it becomes actually a much simpler job overall.
Even with crops, I mean, I can see the point about moving animals. But if you're planting three or four or five or six kind of vegetables and stuff all together,
anytime you've got a crop system, you've got more more labor. But in the kind of sort of no-till systems that are in the book, it's not like pass after pass of a tractor across a landscape and all the chemicals and the diesel, all that sort of stuff that goes into modern farming. It's much more of a much simpler, less intensive system. Though, yeah, you're still growing crops. You still have to harvest them and things like that. Another good example, real quick, in the book is Sam Montoya, who had a grass farm. That's what he called it, down near Albuquerque. And what I like about Sam's story so much is that he was able to raise 220 head of cattle on 93 acres of land. And if you know anything about the West, of course, you need a lot more land than that to raise 220 head. Of course, his land was irrigated. It was down on the Pueblo. But what he did was so interesting. He divided the 93 acres into 3-acre pastures with electric fencing with one central watering source, and then he moved the cows around every day.
That's a lot of different pastures.
It's a lot of pastures. 33 pastures, but 93 acres. He lived across the street. He's retired from his job with the Bureau of Indian Affairs. He said, I didn't want to work too hard in my retirement. And so he would literally walk out his door, walk across the street, open the gate in the fence, let the cows move into fresh feed, close the gate, go home. And that was pretty much
it. That was his day's work.
That was his day's work. And he was growing all this grass. As a consequence, the cows went around in a circle on the land. It took him about a month to kind of get through all that. And he had fat animals. I mean, a grass-fed, off-the-grid animals on 93 acres of irrigated ground. And that's about double the standard production stocking rates on irrigated ground. So he could double production sustainably, regeneratively, grass-fed food, and feed potentially a lot of people from a little bit of land. And this is sort of the great question, the non-trivial things that we were talking about before. How are we going to feed all these people? There are a lot of people on the planet.
Yeah.
More coming. And so if you listen to Monsanto and those guys, they're going to tell you, well, we know what to do. More of the same, right? More
And this is the question. It's like, is the question even, how are we going to feed all those people? Or is the question, how are we going to sustain soil to grow the plants that we eat and feed the animals that we eat in a way that we don't use it up? Because, I mean, the depletion of soil and the erosion of soil is a gigantic problem. And even the people who have these, like, monocrop farms in Iowa. I mean, we had Craig Childs on the air not long ago. And he walked across one of those cornfields in Iowa. It took him days. And he was looking, and he's one of the most observant people that you can ever meet. And he was looking for any species besides corn.
Right.
And there was almost nothing. I mean, he would rejoice when he saw some little bitty worm somewhere or something. And of course, the farmers are at war with the industrial farmers are at war with that little worm that he saw. But the point is, the soil gets worse and worse every year.
Right.
And at a certain point, it collapses.
Right. So that's chemical farming.
Yeah.
And that's what he's looking at. And what we're talking about throughout this book is biological farming. The biology in the soil, the microbes, all that sort of stuff, keep them alive. So you pour chemicals on them, you kill them all, then you got to put more stuff on to keep the fertility up.
It's one is alive, one is dead.
Right. One is alive, one is dead. And you've got to keep putting those inputs in that dead system in order to grow live crops. And it's just more chemicals, more chemicals, more chemicals.
And you always have to put more.
Right. So the chemical companies love that, right?
Yeah.
So they're going to feed you all this stuff to put on your farm. I remember I describe in the book a chapter about cover cropping, going to a cornfield on a very sustainably managed biological farm in Kansas owned by Gail Fuller. And it was a workshop, and they handed us all butterfly nets. And I thought, what are we doing? And he said, go out into the field and swipe it for 50 times. Swipe this butterfly net back and forth through the corn. Come back and see what you got. But we all did that.
Like just in the air?
In the corn. So you're down there kind of swiping it back and forth. You're just going shh, 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 like that through the corn. And came back full of bugs and spiders in particular. And it was an entomologist there who would go through all these nets and pull out the spiders. And there were green spiders and red spiders and black spiders. And this is a cornfield. But it's a cornfield that is biologically alive. It's organic, of course, but it's also how he manages his corn. He likes weeds. He likes all this stuff that grows. And life just perpetuates life. And so, and he didn't mind spiders. He does mind bugs. He's got good productivity in his farm fields.
Yeah.
But, you know, he's such an anomaly, even in Kansas. You know, he's just a weirdo in the farming community. Like, what are you doing? And then you look through the net and go, holy smokes, there's life in his fields.
Yeah.
So that's what Craig Childs is. And he's looking at the other side of that.
Yeah.
So all the different chapters in the book, relate back to life, nature, best ideas, stop plowing, all those kinds of cool things that are low tech, to come back to your original question.
We're talking to Courtney White about his book, 2% Solutions for the Planet. Now, why is it called 2% Solutions?
Well, yeah, so there's three reasons why. It's to do with soil carbon. So if you're a gardener, the black soil in your garden is mostly carbon. And if you increase just by 2%, which is a tiny amount, you get all these benefits that flow from increased carbon in soils. Better water retention, more productivity, more microbes in the soils, all that sort of stuff from a very little bit of carbon that you can generate naturally from the air and from the plants and the roots. So 2% more carbon, and the workforce is 2% of the American population, farmers and ranchers. That's all we got, 2%. They're the ones that are going to do most of the work. And finally, 2% of the national GDP. And that's just a number I pulled out of the air, in the sense that it doesn't take much money to do all this cool stuff. It doesn't take many people, and you don't have to do a lot to the soil to get cascading benefits for the climate, for our food, for our water, for jobs. It's just a little bit of stuff. And again, that's contrary to the main narrative that we hear today. That's got to have big solutions, big amounts of money, big technology, big treaties among nations. And that may be true in some respects, but we can start right now at the level of grassroots with small solutions, 2% solutions, that we know work.
So one of the things, after having talked about low tech, there are some really interesting technologies that are going on. One of them has to do with putting solar panels on farms that both generate energy that you need and provide shades for the crops under them, which, as the planet warms and dries, can be really just mutually beneficial. It's almost like having multi-cropping.
Right. And I didn't want to give a sense that there's not high-tech involved. There's actually definitely some. It's I like the term appropriate technology. It's scaled technology for the problem at hand. So that you just described what's called agrivoltaism's project. Came out of France originally, where Europe has space issues. They're trying to get renewable energy and food together from the same space. So they a group of French scientists looked at putting solar panels above farm fields, and just kind of all that came from that. So there's solar technology there, but it meets low tech, so it meets the farming system. It's just, you know, you kind of work out to the details. And there are, the whole middle section of the book looks at the idea of technology and appropriate technology. The role of the internet, open source software, computing power, some monitoring devices, things like that, that are out there that can help farmers and ranchers do their job. And it actually, of all the things that are in the book, I find that the most exciting, because it's especially the next generation coming along. They bring their techiness to these old problems, food and water. And so Dorn Cox is profiled in the book, and Dorn is a farmer in New Hampshire, where he went into high-tech industry, came back to the farm, brought with him a whole kind of knowledge about the internet and the software, and computing power, and he uses and the internet, and he uses it all to manage his farm. He has a great quote: "Farming isn't rocket science; it's more complicated than that." And, and he's right, because he's looking at fossil fuel use. He's trying to look at the right kind of measurements in the soils to manage his farm, and that stuff exists out there. And this is what's cool. And he uses it. And then he links the farms together through the internet, and they talk to each other, and they share information. And that's the future. I think your smartphone plus organic regenerative farming, for example.
Now, do we have any idea, I mean, when you read a book like this, the 2% Solutions for the Planet, and there are so many people, and when you go to the Kivira Coalition conferences, there are people really all over the world who are doing these amazing things and innovative things that really have the potential to make the world a better place and are already making little pieces of the world a better place. But are they also, I mean, even 2% of all farming and ranching?
Well, you know, that's a good question. And no, I think it's more than that. Certainly when we got started 20 years ago, it was a very small fraction of the larger population, but so much has changed in 20 years. And not just the number of farmers and ranchers doing this, but the number of people in cities buying their food has increased. There's more farms. There's more of a general awareness of these issues. Certainly the challenges have climbed in 20 years, a lot more concern about climate and things like that. So there's still a small amount of people at doing these things. And what I tried to do in the book was really just show readers alternate models to what the general narrative is today. That big ag is only got the answers, or big government, or big whatever. No. I mean, at a 2% scale, there's all these different models that work. They're regenerative. They've been beta tested. They're profitable. There's more now than there were before. I couldn't put a number to it. I mean, I think about the number of organic farms that have risen in less, or farmers markets, or the amount of foods sold in stores that comes from regenerative farms certainly has increased. I couldn't put a number to it. I know that the USDA tries, and they have said that the number of small farms in this country has increased. Where everything else has decreased, the number of small farms has increased.
Interesting.
Particularly by young women farmers. There's kind of a link there. I don't know the exact numbers, but there is more than there has been. Are we there yet? No, not by a long shot. Lots of problems and challenges in the way of scaling up these solutions. But I just wanted folks to understand that the solutions existed in the first place.
One thing that I think is really interesting and important about all of this is a lot of the time the kind of farming and ranching that people whom you profile are doing is actually more economically viable per acre than big industrial farming. It's definitely less carbon dioxide producing than big industrial farming. And it also has in it values of conservation, wildlife, and so on, which, I mean, I think it's just a really interesting area philosophically because, I mean, there are some people, ranchers, whom you have brought to the conference in the past and are bringing now, whose bottom line really is this economically profitable for my business?
Right.
And it turns out that thinking about ecosystems is profitable. And many of us think about ecosystems as, I mean, they have a right to life. They have a right to live regardless of whether they're economically profitable. But a lot of time it's both. Right. It's not necessarily a conflict.
Well, and on a philosophical level, what's important, I think, is for many folks, you're not going to get rich at this. This is not about wealth. So we have an economic system that just tries to drive everybody towards making as much money as possible. So for most of these ranchers I know, it's profitable, it's enough for them, but they're not going to get wealthy on this. And when we think about regenerative solutions to problems, carbon and soils, we just have to rethink what wealth means. Wealth means health. It means diversity. It means animals. It means all these different things. You know, a healthy climate, not just how much money we can make from exploiting whatever we're going to exploit. And it's just, on a philosophical level, it really challenges us to rethink some of our basic economic stuff, which is just to take a resource, maximize its production, put the money in our pockets, and say, see you later.
This have a lot of people working for so little money that they're on government programs and are really poor. I mean, with wealth comes poverty, basically, like it or not.
And what's fun about this is that so many of the ranchers and farmers and other folks are good capitalists. I mean, they look at profit is not a dirty word. Profit motive works, but it's at a different scale and it's with different goals. And so I'm not folks in the environmental movement tend to kind of jump on the bandwagon that our economic system can do nothing right, which is not true. I mean, it's more the kind of the mom and pop scale of, or somebody refers to sort of ag in the middle idea that the cooperatives and the farmers and ranchers and the folks involved in the solar power or things like that, they have profit making motives, but it's a profit. It's a goal that's very, very different than the corporate model. So,
which is continual growth and expansion.
Right, which Wendell Berry describes the motive of most corporations as trying to make a small pile of money into a bigger pile of money.
Right.
And that's, you know, that's behind a lot of the troubles we're at. Certainly defines a lot of industrial agricultural motives. And again, and though I don't go into the economics of this so much, I go into really more of the land practices. The folks in the book are profit-making businesses.
Yeah. Jack Loeffler turns his phrase for that is turning habitat into money.
Right.
It's just about time to go. We're talking to Courtney White about his book, 2% Solutions for the Planet, 50 low-cost, low-tech, nature-based practices for combating hunger, drought, and climate change. It's a wonderful book. I have to say, you are just a terrific writer. Every book of yours that I've read, and we've had you on the air, I think, for pretty much every one over the years, one just feels like, I just feel like I'm driving in the car with you and you're talking, or we're sitting at a dinner table and you're telling a story. It's just wonderful writing, and it's full of pictures and highly accessible. The Kivira Coalition can be found on the web at kiviracoalition.org, and we'll link to it at santaferadiocafe.org. But I also want to allow you, if you would like, to invite people to the conference next week. Or is it still open for registrants?
It is not, actually. Folks can walk in, however.
Okay.
It's an almost a sold-out event. Last numbers I saw that were right at the limit for the room. There's always a few folks that don't show up. So if anybody's listening and really wants to hear more about these kinds of things, the conference this year features Paul Hawken, who's going to talk about a project he's doing that's similar to this called Project Drawdown. They're actually putting a lot of hard numbers to all the different things that draw down carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, including farming, ranching, but also a bunch of tech stuff that they're looking at. So it's kind of a multi-pronged effort here to kind of deal with some of the same issues. So he'll be there. A bunch of folks in the book who are profiled will be there speaking. If folks are interested, it's in Albuquerque. It's at the Embassy Suites. There'll be walk-in room if folks want to just kind of cruise on down.
And anyone can go to the Paul Hawken talk.
And the Paul Hawken talk is open to the public.
On Wednesday night.
Wednesday night, yeah, 7 o'clock.
Courtney White, co-founder and current creative director of the Kivira Coalition, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design.